and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. What has changed since the so-called 12-day war? All of the main actors involved, Iran, Israel, and the United States, are claiming victory. But none of the core issues leading to the conflict have been resolved. In fact, diplomacy and negotiations appear to be less likely than before. This isn't over. Crosstalking the 12-day war, I'm joined by my guest Larry Johnson in Tampa. He's a former CIA analyst and U.S. State Department counterterrorism official. In Beirut, we have Marwa Osman. She is an assistant professor at the Lebanese International University and a political commentator. And in Maykop, we cross to Lisa Isaac. She is an international relations specialist. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Larry, let me go to you first in Tampa. As I said in my introduction, the three main actors involved in this war are claiming victory. I think it's pretty obvious if you're dispassionate, one side won and the other two lost or were humiliated. But what has really changed? And is this really a ceasefire? Because what are the parameters of this ceasefire? We haven't been told. And we have Israeli military officials saying they're preparing for the next round. So Trump, with all of his ridiculous boasting, it seems quite hollow. I'm waiting for the next round. How about you?
Well, it's a de facto ceasefire, but it is not a de jure. It's not really a legal one. Iran, in my view, came out on this as the victor, simply because they survived a coordinated, long-planned attack to destroy Iran, to eliminate the existing leadership, to cause a breakup of the society. And to put it under the control of Western interests. This had nothing really to do with uranium enrichment and Iran's alleged quest for a nuclear weapon. This was about destroying Iran as a political entity, and particularly the Islamic Republic, and then replacing it with someone who would be, for a better word, a lackey of the West. And this is all, I believe, targeted primarily at Russia and China. Because Iran, within the broader context of events, it because of its role in BRICS, because of its oil, it represents a threat to the West as it's trying to cling to its hegemony as being the leading financial power.
You know, Marwa, the Israelis, there's an interesting juxtaposition. I've seen coverage of people in the streets of Tehran celebrating what they understand is to be at least a victory in this stage of the conflict. I'm absolutely convinced it's not over. But I didn't see the same kind of parades in Israel. And there is the realization that, Iran has deterrence. It can deter. That is a big outcome of this conflict. Israel, if we look what's the ongoing genocide, what we saw with Hezbollah, the destruction of the government of Syria, they thought this was going to be a walk in the park, but they were rudely surprised. Marwa.
Definitely. And look, Peter, victory narratives in modern warfare, particularly when they are asymmetric, they often obscure more than they actually reveal. And we know that Iran was hit. It was directly attacked by the U.S. and the Israeli axis in a blatant attack, act of aggression. But it came out of it unbroken. It's still operational because it was still able throughout 12 days to throw at Tel Aviv for the first time in its history 300 ballistic missiles, added to that Khaybar missiles and whatnot that caused a lot of damage. But at the same time, the main objective that Zionist Israel was talking about, which was the regime change or even the deterrence, was a catastrophic failure because Iran's leadership, it remained united. We are seeing people in the streets celebrating. We heard what the leader of the revolution, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said. Its populace did not rise in dissent as it was expected by the West that it will happen, as if it's Syria, for example, but it was not. We also have its regional alliances, as you mentioned, Hezbollah, Ansarullah. We have the PMU in Iraq and other. They also expressed open solidarity. Can you imagine what would have happened if these also support fronts had opened? But but Iran did not want that. They were ready to do it on their own. Add to that, that they, for the first time, directly hit a Persian Gulf base, military base for the Americans in Qatar al-Udeid Air Base. That was also a very big red line crossed after the Americans went in with the B-2 over Fordow, which, by the way, as per American media, it's not me saying it, was a big failure. It did not actually eradicate, as they are saying, the Fordow plant, because if it did, having, as the IAEA is saying, 60% of enriched uranium, it would have been a catastrophe, at least similar to what happened in Chernobyl across the region of West Asia. And we all see on the map that all the countries are close to one another. We did not even see the slightest of that happening. Added to that, Iran remains firmly rooted in West Asia's map. There was no disintegration. There was no paralysis, because the first day, the first hours, they killed more than 20 of the top leadership. But within 13 hours, Iran was able to replace them and start retaliating. So there was no Syria scenario, as you are saying. And Iran is firmly rooted right here in its strategic axis. Thus, while maybe victory may not be elusive in the Western lexicon as we know it, but survival against empire is in itself a profound geopolitical statement.
That is so absolutely right. Not losing is winning. And that's what I thought all along during this. You know, Lisa, it's really interesting is that the way it's being framed in Western media, it's never mentioned that two nuclear powers, the United States and Israel, attacked a non-nuclear power that is in the non-proliferation treaty. This is earth-shattering, because this tells the entire global South that even if you play by the rules, you involve yourself in Western institutions or Western-controlled institutions, you still can be a victim. That is a game changer. It's a game changer for the global South, for most people paying attention, not for pockets in the Western world, in the United States and Europe. Lisa.
Yes, let me just bring a different narrative to the discussions, just to be a little bit provocative to this discussion. Since we have spoken about the Iranian victory, let's bring a little bit of its losses from this 12 days war. We can't also neglect that 30 leading figures from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard generals have been assassinated. In addition to that, the major of the nuclear scientist Iran has lost also. Destroying the nuclear project, as the U.S. has claimed. More importantly, losing and killing more than 400 people. Most of them are from the civilians. And severely damaging the ballistic missile project, in which has Israel destroyed over that 50% of the launchers and production facilities. So, and Israel also has reduced Iran missiles stockpiles up almost.
Lisa, I don't disagree with any of that, but it remains to be unclear. I think it's pretty obvious who wanted it to stop. It wasn't Iran that asked it to stop. It was Israel and Donald Trump panicking that he was getting himself in a war that he didn't want. Well, he's already got that war. That war is the precedent has already been established. Let me go back to Larry. Larry, that is another thing. The U.S. attacked Iran with its military might, and Iran is still standing. That's another lesson here. American military might does not necessarily mean it's going to get its way.
Well, there's still a lot of, let's call it, misinformation, lies, and things that just don't add up. For example, we're told that the B-2 bombers dropped multiple of these GBU-57 bombs, which each one weighs 30,000 pounds.
Jesus.
Well, the B-2 bomber can only carry a 40,000-pound bomb, okay? So yeah. How does one bomber carry two bombs? Doesn't make sense on that front.
Well, that's taking advantage of the American educational system. People don't even know arithmetic anymore. Keep going.
Yeah. Well, they don't add, they don't subtract. The attacks on al-Udeid, that was all, you know, this was, I call it, kabuki theater.
Yeah.
We saw the same thing happen in 2017, 2018. I had firsthand information back then about what was going on, where the United States, the military command actually at al-Udeid called up the Russians and said, hey, because the U.S. was planning to strike in Syria. Sharat was, I think, the first one in 2017, called him up in advance and said, okay, yeah, we're going to be attacking on this date and this time and this place with this number of weapons. So get your people. That was all for show. You know, it was a way to get out. Here's what I don't understand, Peter. Iran had Israel on the ropes. Iran had effectively shut down the only two remaining container ports in Israel. Without those container ports, Israel wasn't going to get any more goods coming in or going out. They'd shut down the only international airport at Ben Gurion, so nobody could leave the country. Iran really let Israel off the hook. I'll be critical of the Iranian leadership on this. They could have put Israel down, and they chose not to.
Yeah, well, then we go into, Marwa, let me go to you, because then you get into this kind of murky area where it's existential, and then the U.S. could have gone up the escalation ladder. I get what Larry is saying, but I think that there was that danger. And Iran is a very pragmatic and cautious country. 50 seconds before we go to the break, dear.
I want to just answer about the NPT, because it's important for the people to know, Peter, that Iran is a signatory of the NPT.
That's right.
Israel is not. Iran's nuclear program has been the most inspected in modern history
over
15 years of IAEA oversight, even as it had repeatedly reaffirmed that Tehran has no active weapons program. But Israel possesses an undeclared arsenal of at least 90 nuclear warheads, according to the CIPRI, which is the Stockholm International Peace Research Institution, with no international scrutiny. So who's really the bad guys here? Who's not really applying international law and abiding by it? But the issue is, well-known verse of victory, as we have been taught throughout history, does not apply here. And the issue is, as you said, they completely paralyzed Zionist Israel, and Netanyahu is now in a big, big problem. The obstacle, first obstacle he's facing is Monday as a trial of his own for being someone who has betrayed the trust of the Israelis on several matters. So now is a very important time. But I do agree that a lot of people as well, not just you, Peter, inside of Iran, they're asking their leadership to continue. They consider this
just Marwa, hold that thought. We're going to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on the so-called 12-day war. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Remind you, we're discussing the so-called 12-day war. Okay, I want to go back to Marwa in Beirut. You were talking about the importance of the non-proliferation treaty and Iran's adherence to it. But Marwa, after the so-called 12 days war, why would Iran stay in the non-proliferation treaty? Why would it even, in any circumstance, allow the IAEA back in? I think that's we've drawn through that line. Go ahead.
I don't think they will, because on Thursday we did see breaking news from the parliament, from the Iranian parliament, saying that they will. They have basically left the IAEA agreement, and I think that the NPT might be coming next if this thing escalates. But let me tell you, but labeling the confrontation that happened as a 12-day war is, I'm sorry to say, it's a bit historically misreading, because what unfolded was not a discrete conflict. It was the latest flare-up, basically,
exactly,
in a long a continent of enmity that traces back to basically the 1953 CIA orchestrated coup inside of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then came the 1979 Islamic Revolution and the enduring clash between the anti-imperial sovereignty and the Western hegemony in the area. So the most recent escalation that we saw between the entity and the Islamic Republic was not an isolated episode, but maybe it's a culmination of years of strategic patience exercised by Iran and by aggression from Zionist Israel against Iran. We can remember when they attacked the embassy, and then when they attacked Iranian land, while they were actually committing genocide in Gaza and bombing Lebanon, Yemen, and Syria all the time. So we also see that there is a big span of a resistance axis that might have been weakened throughout the past 20 months, but it is not a spontaneous reaction. But this is an evolution of an ideological and geopolitical front forged in shared experience against the U.S. and Israeli aggression against the people of this region. So this is very important. Now, whether it's going to continue or not, I see it's continuing. And I wanted to tell you, Peter, that on the ground, the people that I've spoken to, the people that I've called my friends inside of Iran, they all want their leadership to continue. They don't want to stop because the 600 plus people killed, plus the 20 or 25 plus leaders and scientists who were murdered by Zionist Israel, is not enough for them that it ended the way it did. They want to see Zionist Israel completely destroyed the same way it did to Gaza. So you are right. This is just phase one.
You know, Lisa, Trump is taking all the credit for it. I don't really care who takes credit for ending hostilities, even if it's temporary. But it seems to me that this ceasefire, and we know Israel's history with ceasefires, they just want to lick their wounds. They want to restock their missiles and all other means for to continue the conflict, anti-missile defense, for example, here. Obviously, Iran is thinking the same thing. The only question is will the United States? I firmly believe that Israel and Iran will start exchanging missiles again. I don't know when, maybe this week, maybe in 6 weeks, maybe in a year. But the question is, and the precedent that's been set, is that Donald Trump is willing to use military force against a country that doesn't have nuclear weapons and a country that the United States is not at war with. This is why I keep saying it's not over. Lisa.
Let's be a little bit optimistic about this, and let's hope that no more wars will be waged in West Asia or Middle East or whatever you can call this region, because it bared enough, I think, from all the bloodshed that we are witnessing starting from even before 7 October. The credits, of course, it doesn't go for anyone. If we will think about that, the ceasefire that have been waged imposed by Trump is going to bring the two parties into the negotiation table. In my opinion, that in the negotiation table only will determine who was the win and who was the victory from this war, because we will see and we will monitor and we will observe which party can impose its own terms on the negotiation table. Then we can decide, and maybe we can get a more, you know, comprehensive view to that, to what happened for this whole 12 days war. And if we could just take a more, you know, a bigger picture to the to this war, it's not only, as my colleague have mentioned right now, it's not only about Iran, it's about the whole Iran proxies and alliance in the region. Looking at the trajectory of the events that happened since 7 October and the collapse of Iran alliances in the region, whether it was Hezbollah in Lebanon, Houthis also was targeted, the collapse of Assad regime, and even now in Iraq, we don't know what the scenario that is prepared by Netanyahu government there to Iraq, and now facing face-to-face with Iran. This is really, we don't know where the things is, the escalation ladder of the situation is going to lead us. So it's not only, as they have mentioned, about Iran, it's about the whole proxies in the region. And if we don't sit on the table...
Yeah, but the evidence of the last 2 weeks, Larry, is that, and this is only my opinion here, is that the proxies, the axis of resistance, well, it wasn't all that important at the end of the day because Iran could take care of itself. And plus, it has the wherewithal. It's not fighting a militia. It's a nation state. It is well-armed. I mean, this is a different kettle of fish. I mean, the United States and Israel can attack militias. They can have subterfuge. They can have covert operations. But when it comes to conventional warfare, toe to toe, the United States and Israel are left wanting. Larry.
Yeah, well, I don't think most people understand or appreciate that the expectation on the part of not only Israel, but the United States, was that this covert operation that led to the assassination of several members of the IRGC, followed by the murder and assassination of nuclear scientists, they really expected this to collapse the Iranian government. That was the expectation. And frankly, they were shocked that Iran got back up off the floor. My understanding is, you know, the cyber attack that Israel carried out was also accompanied. The U.S. played a role in that cyber attack that disabled a lot of the radar and air defense systems. But we also have to recognize IAEA was a cooperator in this plot.
Yep.
If it was not for IAEA, they would not have had the names, addresses, and phone numbers of the Iranian scientists. They were complicit in the murder of those people. And the ultimate irony here is, here's Iran, in my view, foolishly thinking that if we just play by the rules, if we just suck up to the international order, if we sign the non-proliferation treaty, they'll leave us alone and let us be a nation.
No, Larry, I disagree. I disagree with you. Is that that line of thinking in the end showed the hypocrisy and the lies and the deceit of the West. They played the long game and they won. They won on virtue. I'm sorry, Marwa. I know you want to jump in, but Iran is the good guy in this one, Marwa.
No, I agree, but I think they're being played.
Because he doesn't, my good friend doesn't really understand the ideology that is of the Islamic Revolution. I'm not here to explain it, but there's no longer any doubt that the so-called rules-based international order has been reduced to a rhetorical shield of power politics. I mean, Israel's recent attack on the Iranian sovereignty targeting military dual-use sites was carried out without UN authorization, without international consensus, and without any legitimate pretext. We keep forgetting this. It was a naked violation of the UN Charter's prohibition on the use of force against any sovereign nation. Even worse than that, the US kept saying that we have nothing to do with this, but they were directly attributing to this war, providing logistical support, satellite intelligence support, effectively co-signing the assault against the Iranian population. This is not the behavior of nations that uphold international norms. I mean, we've seen this for the past 70 years, but it is basically the modus operandi of a rogue bloc seeking to enforce order through might, not through law.
And Marwa, I would point out, in a complete agreement with you, what we had, this spider web attack using Ukraine against Russia, this kind of covert approach. This is the same thing they were doing with Iran. This is the collective. It's the collective West going after its real or perceived enemies to maintain hegemony. Marwa, keep going.
Yeah, because contrast to how they react or how they arrest Iran, Iran's response. It issued warnings to neighboring countries when it wanted to fire. It notified the UN. It launched targeted strikes on military installations, not on civilian infrastructure. If they wanted to kill civilians, they would have killed civilians. In legal terms, that falls directly under Article 51 of the UN Charter, the right to self-defense. That's the difference between those rogue states and between a sovereign nation. Moreover, Israel, just an undeclared nuclear state in the region, continues to violate countless UNSC resolutions. It is being backed by the US from its illegal occupation of Palestinian territories to bombing Lebanon, annihilating my people. 6,000 people died, by the way, this year in Lebanon. Added to that, decimated our lives, our shops, our houses. My house in South Lebanon doesn't exist anymore because Israel took it, burned it to the ground. Meanwhile, the U.S. enforces an economic war in Iran through unilateral sanctions with extraterritorial reach, essentially criminalizing even trade with a sovereign country. That is a 47-year-old war against the Islamic Republic.
Okay, we're almost, Larry, I want to finish up with you. Meanwhile, what's back in focus now is it always should be, is the genocide in Gaza. The world must continue to understand that genocide is being committed, and who is committing it, Larry?
Yeah, well, it goes without question that the world still ignores that. The only country that has actually fought on behalf of the people of Gaza are the Houthis in Yemen. They have made it a point that they're going to shut down Israel until Israel stops the repression.
Come on, why are you undermining my people too? Come on, Lebanon paid a big price, and we are still ready to pay that price.
I do not deny that Lebanon's paid a great price, but in terms of actually fighting, in terms of actually sending missiles in, trying to shut down Ben Gurion, trying to destroy military sites inside Israel.
We did that for 14 months until they killed Hassan.
All right. Let's keep the unity here together. There always are nuances. That's what intelligent people always give us, is the nuance and not just the blob message like we get from the Trump administration. Fascinating discussion. I want to thank my guests in Beirut, Tampa, and in southern Russia as well. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.